Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Let's do some news that you can use. So starting now, let's talk about the prescribing cascade. This is one of the common problems that happens in medicine, especially in modern medicine where where doctors are forced to see a lot of patients and spend a whole lot of time wrestling with computers. Not what we signed up for. We were going to stomp out diseases and alleviate suffering. We weren't trying to solve programming issues. But the prescribing cascade is something that all doctors can fall into. So we're going to talk about a specific instance of that. This came out in some of the issues that were published back in 2020, and I know I missed a lot of them because I was focusing on COVID. So to a certain extent, we pick up stories as they appear relevant. So what happens often when people have high blood pressure is that they are started on a class of drugs called calcium channel blockers. Verapamil is one of those. Diltiazem is one of them. These are great drugs because they relax the blood vessels. So we're often giving them to people who have angina or maybe some coronary artery disease. They're particularly commonly given to people with atrial fibrillation because they help control the rate. Atrial fibrillation is not such a bad thing to have if the rate is, say, 68 to 90. You're able to get around and move and climb stairs and do most of what you can do, just a little bit more tired. But when your rate goes up to like 120 or 130, something we call a rapid ventricular response, you feel like you are you've just run a marathon or you've fallen to the side of the track, not succeeding in running your marathon, you can barely get around. Rapid ventricular rate is readily controlled with these calcium channel blockers, so we use them a lot. And we also use them for blood pressure because then you get, you know, bang for your buck. However, one of the common side effects of these drugs is swelling in the legs, like ankle edema, like you might get if you go on a 6-hour or a 12-hour airplane ride and discover when you land at your destination that you can't get your shoes back on. Well, that's lower extremity edema, and it's much more common in people who are started on these drugs. And if you don't warn the patient, then they're like, oh, my legs are swelling, I better go in and get checked. And if they end up seeing a different doctor who doesn't inquire how long they've been on that calcium channel blocker, they may not realize that this is actually a side effect. Typically, patients will receive a diuretic, to a water pill, if you will, within 90 days of starting these calcium channel blockers. So now we're on a second drug to take care of the side effect of the first drug. And this is what you call a prescribing cascade. And unfortunately, it's not unusual for people to end up on a third drug. So for example, one study was done this was done in Canada, where they actually have large local databases. So they looked at the 90 days after one of these calcium channel blockers was prescribed. People over 65 with no other major health problems, no history of heart failure, no advanced renal disease, the sorts of things that would give you swelling in your legs. And after starting these drugs, about 1 out of 20 of people ended up being prescribed a new diuretic, 5%. Then they looked at, of those who were started on diuretic, how many were ending up in the emergency room with a complication or hospitalized. And the answer was twice as many people ended up hitting the ER or actually hospitalized after starting these agents due to the fluid retention. And this would probably, a lot of these cases were people who got very, very tired because the diuretics stole their potassium. And low potassium affects your muscles, and you would feel it as fatigue. Also, If your potassium gets very low, it can affect your heartbeat, and you're going to end up hospitalized. So there are lots of reasons to be concerned about taking a drug to fix the side effects of the first drug. And we get into this problem all the time, and we end up with people who have all this polypharmacy. And then we doctors are reluctant to stop the drug because we're afraid, you know, you've got a 65, 70-year-old person. They've got a couple of health problems. They've been to the ER twice in the last month. And you're going to stop a drug that the ER doctor put them on? Well, hello to the lawyers, right? Because the family will blame you if something goes sideways for stopping the drug, whereas adding another drug, much less likely to get you in trouble. And that kind of goes through people's heads sometimes when you're trying to stop drugs. We need a safe space for deprescribing, and we need to be teaching doctors and giving them permission and encouraging them with little reminders. Gee, this person's on three drugs. Two of these are redundant. Would you like to stop one? That would be a good use for AI. And throughout this program, I'm going to be giving you good uses for AI. Coming up after just station ID and a short break to talk about money, we will be back with more. And we're going to go into a series, if you will, of several things called cheap versus expensive, with a question mark about whether we need to be using these expensive drugs, whether the data supports it. So you might be taking one of these drugs. Wouldn't surprise me. So stay tuned. We have a tendency in our culture to go for the in medical culture, that is, to go for the shiny. Actually, it's not new, and shiny is actually kind of an American thing now that I think about it. So we're going to talk about two classes of drugs and where they should be used and where they probably don't need to be used. And the first instance here is in the case of these very expensive oral anticoagulants. They're called direct anticoagulants or factor 10A inhibitors. And these drugs run most people around $300, $350 a month. That's a lot of change, particularly if you're on a fixed income. And they are drastically overprescribed because they're easy. They are a labor-saving device. So let's take, for example, someone who's had a stroke. There are two different kinds of strokes. There's embolic strokes, which is where a small bit of something, blood clot, usually breaks off from somewhere and finds its way into the brain and blocks up the flow of blood to a part of the brain. There are thrombotic strokes, which is where that blood clot is much larger, comes from the carotid and blocks out an entire big part of the brain. And in those cases, it's usually much worse. And there's also hemorrhagic strokes. And hemorrhagic strokes occur when a blood vessel breaks and blood escapes into the brain. So we're talking now about embolic stroke of undetermined origin, which these are strokes that people do not have atrial fibrillation, which is a definite risk factor for a stroke. And it's been established that the factor 10A inhibitors are superior to the other agents that might be used for that. And so this type of stroke can theoretically be treated with either an aspirin or with a factor 10A inhibitor. And almost universally, the trend has been, since these drugs came out, to use the 10A inhibitors, which are, as I said, way more expensive than an aspirin. But if you actually do some science, and you know me, I'm all about doing science, and you look at the groups of people, this was a trial that was done where they took 1,000 patients, and they followed them for almost 2 years, and they looked at the recurrent stroke rates in people who got aspirin and people who got the expensive drug. And what they found was the same recurrent stroke rate, just exactly the same over that period of time. Antiplatelet therapy is actually better. In other words, the aspirin pill is marginally better because it has fewer side effects in this population. So why are we using the more expensive drug? Now, a little bit more on the factor 10A inhibitors. This is the Eliquis. You know, that's the one whose brand name comes to mind to me, so I'm going to stick with that one. That one's Apabixin. And this class of drugs are new. They're still under patent. That's why they're expensive. Plus, fast forward 17 years, they go generic, and then they probably come up with something better that they can patent so that they can continue to take our money. But let's continue with my thread here. These drugs are superior for two things. Chronic atrial fibrillation, which has a substantial stroke risk, 3% a year, 3 to 4% a year. That's enough of a stroke risk that you want to do something. And they work way better than aspirin. There is the old class of drugs that we used for this, which was warfarin, is very inconvenient and difficult because anytime you eat vegetables, you screw up your drug level. Vitamin K reverses warfarin. It gets really complicated to maintain a safe level. This drug has a narrow therapeutic range, and it takes a long time to wear off. So if we have to do an emergency surgery on someone, it can be very difficult to stop them from bleeding. So we have to reverse it with big doses of vitamin K, but then we make them hypercoagulable, we overshoot, and we run into the same kind of cascade of pendulum swinging that we see with other agents. So interesting information if you are being treated for, let's say, an occult stroke with one of these factor 10A inhibitors. It is not superior to aspirin, and you might want to think about switching to something else. There are a lot of things that we shouldn't be using these drugs for. It's actually less safe for mechanical heart valves. It's less safe for rheumatic atrial fibrillation. It's less safe for the antiphospholipid or lupus anticoagulant syndrome. And it's much less safe for people who've had an aortic valve replacement. These people should all be on an aspirin tablet instead. We never want to use those during pregnancy. Probably shouldn't use them in people with end-stage renal disease. So there's a lot going on here that's nuanced, that isn't getting the kind of nuance we'd like to see. Tests for screening actually, I'm going to hold off on the colon cancer and pivot to something everybody can use, because if we're not an older relative to somebody, we have an older relative ourselves. So you're either in one category or the other, and either way, this is relevant to you. And that is orthostatic hypotension. So one of the things, it's kind of a stereotype, as we age, we fall down more. And some of that is because we have balance issues, and some of it's because we have neuropathy, and some of it's because we have early Parkinson's disease and we're walking with a shuffling gait, or we're dealing with a hip arthritis and that's throwing our gait off. But it's a given that people fall more often. Sometimes we can't figure out why they fell. They didn't trip over something. They don't have any of the conditions I've mentioned. And one of the unsuspected things is something called delayed orthostatic hypotension. And that turns out to be more common than people realize. So let me start with how we test for that. Orthostatic hypotension basically means you stand up and you get dizzy. Now, most of us have had the flu and stayed in bed for 2 or 3 days. And then when we get up to go to the bathroom, we get a head rush and we kind of have to stop and wait. But if you don't stop and wait, you can actually pass out. I personally have passed out due to dehydration while standing there in the surgery department after being on working for 36 hours, holding a retractor, and just, you feel yourself starting to go, a little bit of dizziness, and then you're down. Not everyone sometimes doesn't even get a warning of this, and the older you are, the less likely you are not to get a warning. But the problem with this delayed orthostatic hypotension is you've been standing for a while, and you've been fine, and it suddenly hits you, and this is turning out to be far more common than was generally realized. So you go to the doctor, you've fallen. Maybe your doctor says, let's do orthostatic blood pressures on them. What does that look like? You lie flat for a couple of minutes and they take your blood pressure. Then they sit you up and they take your blood pressure. And then they stand you up and they take your blood pressure. And maybe they wait 2 or 3 minutes and check your blood pressure again. It used to be 5 minutes, but I've noticed it's, you know, we're so busy and we're so time stressed that it's dropped down to about 3 minutes. That may be a really bad idea because a large percentage of people will actually not drop their blood pressure until they've been standing for more than 5 minutes. And so the amount of blood pressure drop you can see is 20 millimeters of mercury. That means going from 120 to 100. And when that happens suddenly, a lot of people are going to go down. So probably we should be testing for 6 minutes. And so they did a study where they were looking at people in the community, elders living in the community greater than 70, who had had previous falls. A lot of them had diabetes. 60% were, quote unquote, pre-frailty. And what is pre-frailty? That's where you're starting to lose muscle mass. You're not frail, you're not rickety yet, but you're starting to get weak. You're using your arms to push on the arms of the chair to stand up. You're bending forward rather than standing straight up. Little things like that. So one test, by the way, for this is to cross your arms over your chest and stand up and not fall down and be able to get up. I see Jane's testing herself over here. Very good, Jane. I can see lots of muscles there. You look good. And so that's important, though. Can you do that? That's a good quick test. But any family member and an automatic blood pressure cuff, you can check out your elder relative, the person that you don't want to be have falling, and you can check them for this. There are drugs and strategies that we can use to help people who have this delayed orthostasis, but first we have to find it. So just like I described, you lie down for 2 minutes, you check the blood pressure, they sit up and for 1 minute, you check the blood pressure, they stand up, you take 3 measurements, 1 immediately. And remember that blood pressure cuff has to be at the level of the heart. So crossing your arm across your chest and grabbing the opposite shoulder is a good way to ensure that that's happening. And then at 3 minutes and then at 6 minutes. And as long as that blood pressure doesn't shift by more than about 10 points and the heart rate does not go up by more than 20 points, you're probably not looking at delayed orthostatic hypotension. And this is an easy screening test that family members can do. So why not give it a try? Let's talk about colon cancer. A couple of fun, not so fun facts is that we're seeing more colon cancer in younger people and more aggressive colon cancer in that group, which really doesn't make a lot of sense. We're not sure we see what we're seeing, but we don't know why we're seeing it. It may have to do with the increasing rate of diabetes. It may have to do with the epidemic of obesity. It may have some other third variables, environmental pollution, the systematic elimination of fiber from our diet because of the changes in the food system. And, you know, we just don't know. There's lots of things you can blame, but the data isn't there. What we're left with as doctors is early detection, because early detection for breast cancer and colon cancer works. We have cut those deaths down by finding cancer early. And we probably need to figure out how to find lots of cancers early rather than waiting until the person with pancreatic cancer turns yellow because they've blocked off their bile ducts. We need to have a different focus, I think. I'm always talking to you about new chemotherapy things, and there are some amazing new discoveries like CAR T cell therapy where you program your own T lymphocytes to attack your cancer. We've made enormous strides, but early detection has really not gotten the attention it deserves. So we're going to talk about two things with respect to colon cancer. And one of them is Cologuard, which is a 10-year-old test now that is a multi-target stool test. So this looks at tumor markers in stool. So it does a test for blood, but it also looks for genetic changes that are characteristic of colon polyps, rapidly growing cells that could turn into cancer, and cancers themselves. We've had this Cologuard test since 2014, and it's finally, it took a long time before Medicare would start paying for it, but it is a better screen than just the FIT test. And if people are unable or unwilling to do screening colonoscopy, it's a good start, because I've never had anybody refuse colonoscopy who did this test and had a positive, which is like, okay, it's not just you might have cancer, it's that you probably do or probably will soon, so maybe you should rethink your stance on this. And I am a big fan of Cologuard testing. However, as I said, with the retreads of the drugs, a new version, a next generation test, was recently released. So we're going to be talking about the new next generation test. And this was 20,000 asymptomatic adults. The average age was 63. And so they compared it to what is currently being done by, say, Kaiser, which is the fecal immunoglobulin test, which is an antibody against human hemoglobin. And so it won't test positive if you had a rare steak the night before or had horseradish, which was the problem with the old stool-guaiac test. We had a lot of false positives. Let me just digress for a moment and say that false positives stink, and they're a real problem with screening testing, because you want to pick up all the cases, right? You want to, if you're going to screen for a disease, you want to not miss any of them. So you have to figure out where you're going to put your threshold, because it's going to be a continuum of results. So where's my threshold? So if you design it to be very sensitive, the problem with that is a lot of tests, most of them in fact, will have a lot of false positives. So if you get a false positive, well, in the case of the Cologuard, you're going to get a colonoscopy, right? But on the other hand, you don't want to miss a colon cancer. So we think in terms of true positives and true negatives. Sometimes the true positives are referred to as the positive predictive value. So remember, we have 20,000 asymptomatic adults. The odds of any one of those adults having colon cancer, if statistically speaking, is about 1 in 20 will have colon cancer that has not been diagnosed. It's a very common disease. If you have a test that is 91% sensitive, let's make it even simpler. Let's suppose, not this case, but let's suppose the test is 99% sensitive and only 1 in 1,000 people are positive, actually have a true positive. So that's 99% sensitive, but the frequency of the disease is low, like 1 in 1,000. Well, then you're going to have 10 positives that are false positives. 999 people won't have the cancer or whatever it is you're looking for. But because the test is 99% accurate, 1% of that 1,000 will, which is 10 people. So for every true positive in that particular setting of the rare disease, you're going to have 10 false positives. In the case of colon cancer, we're talking 1 in 20, so it's not the same rarity, and you get more true positives. But the positive predictive value, even for the Cologuard test, is about 11%. On the other hand, the positive predictive value of a negative test is 91%. So in other words, if you have a negative, you can pretty much feel comfortable not getting that colonoscopy. If you have a positive, you've still got 9-1 against actually having cancer. And that's as good as it gets. We're going to have to accept the false positives along with the true in order to do screening. So can we make it better? Well, here we have a blood test for cancer DNA that may be a new option that eventually takes the place. I've been hearing a lot, and you've been hearing, if you listen, you've been hearing a lot about the virtual biopsy. And these are primarily blood tests that look for the same sort of thing, tumor markers, neoplasia DNA that's floating around in the bloodstream that came from a cancer cell. And you've got fecal hemoglobin. This was a test that looked at the blood test versus that same fecal hemoglobin FIT test that you get from your HMO. It is not approved yet, but they're trying to get it to be good enough. They're, you know, tinkering with it at this point, trying to get it to be good enough that annually, as along with your cholesterol, we would just do a cell-free DNA test to screen you for colon cancer. And particularly in younger people, I mean, colonoscopies are a lot of hassle, right? And you have to do the prep, and there's a small potential for perforation of the bowel. And if we have to start doing colonoscopies on a younger and younger cohort to catch these early diseases, it's going to be really hard to get that done. So it's these liquid biopsies could really be a game changer. This at this particular prototype level, and this is a beta, you know, it's not ready for prime time, but it did detect 88% of not yet metastatic colon cancer. So it found all the stage ones, stage twos, stage threes. It missed 12% of them. It also detected 13% of precancerous, which are advanced. So it was false positive in 10% of people. So again, we've got 10% of people who had a positive test, didn't have cancer. So they're going to have to go through additional screening. I'm wondering if maybe the blood test and something like the stool test, if we could, you know, have a twofer, sort of two views of the situation, that might be a strategy. I don't think we'll ever have a perfect test, but it would be really interesting to co-test and see if that improves the accuracy and gets those false positives down. So will we be seeing a transformation in how we screen for colon cancer over the next few years? I think so. And should that occur, that's super, because we have too many people who are showing up with advanced cancers at a not advanced age. Something for the younger people and maybe the parents who are listening, which is about electronic cigarettes. Now, I remember when vaping first came out, it was actually approved on the basis of the fact that it could be used to help people quit smoking, and it was thought that it might be a bit safer. Well, the safer part really hasn't panned out, but in fact, there's been an unintended consequence, as there often is with new technology, that the number of young people who have never smoked cigarettes who vape has increased. And in this study looking at 2,000 California youth, average age of 17 between 2014 and 2018, this was annual surveys by these young men and women about their respiratory symptoms, shortness of breath, wheezing, coughing, and congestion, cigarette use, e-cigarette use, cannabis use, and passive exposures, and they were asked to rate those in the past 30 days. So what they found was that the prevalence of e-cigarette use in young people went from 10% to 15%. Smoking went from 6% to 10%. By the end of year four, the prevalence of cannabis use in California was 26% of these 17-year-olds. But compared with participants who had never used e-cigarettes, those who used them in the prior 30 days had significantly more shortness of breath, wheezing, and bronchitis symptoms, actually twice the number of symptoms. That is, from a medical standpoint, you know, doubling the risk of wheezing and shortness of breath is huge. If we had an environmental pollutant that did that, the EPA would be climbing up their back legs to get to them, because that is huge. Even after we did the data and we looked for adjusting, so, well, is it just people with asthma? The effect sizes were similar. So we don't ask our patients about vaping, and we should, and particularly we should be really discouraging it and understanding it is not benign, it is not safer, and it may, at least as far as immediate symptoms concerned, be worse.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.